What the heck is the deal with the beef shortage? I've been asked that question a bunch of times by a lot of folks on social media, and I decided that it would probably be best to try to address that with my buddy Javier Goya. He's been a commodities trader for about 25 years and really knows his stuff. So we're going to get down and cover all of that, plus what's going on with some of these other commodities. And I've got to apologize to y'all. I don't know if it's allergies or a cold or something. It's not the Rona, but I got something going on with my voice, so bear with us on this one. Before we get started, I want to tell y'all thanks again for all the reviews you leave me. And if you want a copy of the book, remember that we're doing a pre-order right now on BraxMcCoy.com/TheGlassFactory. You can go snatch that thing up for 25% off and free shipping. Go grab it. Thank y'all. I'm Brax McCoy, and I'm here with my buddy Javier. He's like commodities extraordinaire. Do you want to actually, you know what? Can you just tell us who you are so I don't have to play around?
Sure. Hey, thanks, Braxton. So I am Javier Goya. As those of you who are familiar with the Bird app might know me, you might not. I am on my 25th year in the commercial commodity space as a broker. I have a limited expertise in lots of different commodities. I'd say electricity, heavy oils, light ends, anything with an ain on it, and agriculture, from ethanol to corn, beans, wheat. Braxton mentioned alfalfa on the Bird app the other day. And I'm not a PhD. I'm not an academic by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, I'm a college dropout from Wyoming, who happened to be in a bar one night and 25 years ago, and met some guys and ended up working in the commodity space. And I've been very fortunate and very blessed to have a pretty interesting life in that space. That's led me here to yesterday, and Braxton, and a tweet that he put out yesterday, which is kind of why we're talking.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. That's that might be the first success story I've ever heard that started on a bar stool.
Well, you know, the irony is this: a year after that meeting in a bar, I was in that same bar, and a friend of mine introduced me to my wife.
No kidding.
We were, I promise you, Mrs. Goy and I were married a year later. And so that same bar got me my job and a career, and it also found me my wife.
Very cool. That's very yep. cool. But before we go any further, can you define commodity for people?
Sure. So most people have a general idea of what a commodity is, but it is basically a good in any way, shape, or form you can imagine, a good that can be bought and sold either today or tomorrow. And there's a general definition under which is under argument today as to whether or not it can or cannot be stored. For years, electricity was not treated as a commodity because its lifespan from generation to use was about 10 minutes, whether it was a coal plant, nuclear power plant, whatever it cost to run the lines. It was stored for about 10 minutes. But obviously, with the advent of batteries, it's becoming more commoditized. But that is the general definition. So you either have to burn it, eat it, added into something else, mold it, but that is what a commodity is. Generally, it's everything that we use at some point in time during our day.
Perfect. Yeah. So raw wheat is a commodity and bread is a good, right?
Correct.
Yep. Perfect. So that's for the other idiots out there. Like I'm kind of king idiot, so I like to kind of boil it down like that. Now, on that tweet, we were talking a little bit before, but I think I know which one you're talking about. And I'm actually interested why that one piqued your, got you piqued.
Well, you know, for those of you who may be listening that don't watch the Bird app, you can go to Braxton's feed and go back to April 27th of 2020. So this is about, 13 months ago. And he types out, beef shortages are coming. we can just about guarantee that. The problem is we won't really see the impact for 18 months. The question is, how do we make a culture hooked on instant gratification care about a situation that won't manifest itself for over a year? Question mark. The funny thing is, Braxton, you retweeted yourself yesterday and pointed out that no one interacted with it, but that it was accurate. And that's uncommon, which it started this whole conversation of which I was a part of. It's several other people we know are a part of. And it morphs into, you know, what many of your tweets are, which is fascinating conversation. Mm-hmm. My question to you, and one of the reasons I think why we're talking today is how did you know?
Okay. I was scheduled to go speak in at a conference in Las Vegas. The company that hired me was from San Francisco, and I was supposed to leave Saturday morning. And I was actually just going to drive down instead of fly because my family, my wife wanted to visit her family in Utah. So I got a call from the company that had hired me Friday night after hours. And they said, hey, we're canceling the speech. It sounds like the whole conference is going to get canceled because of this COVID stuff. And I had been listening to Tim Pool a little bit here and there, and he'd been on the coronavirus stuff for, gosh, since like December, you know, of the year before. And all of the shutdowns were starting and they were closing schools. And I was talking to a certain congressman that I wouldn't say no, but that I communicate with sometimes via DM. And this guy works in the ag space, or used to work in the ag space before he became a congressman. And he does still have cattle. And we were just going back and forth on this. And I was saying, well, you close schools. Yeah, that's not going to have an immediate impact on beef because they really don't serve a lot of beef at schools. But what they do serve is a whole bunch of dairy, a ton of dairy. So you close all of those schools and then you have all these, most dairies are contracted, but some aren't. And you have all of these guys who now have milk that they can't get rid of. And what happens to somebody who is in that, and this is just what I was thinking, is someone, if I was trying to run that business and I had just lost, like, let's say 20% of my annual revenue, and I could see it was going to stay that way for the foreseeable future, then what I would try to do is cull some cows and fatten them up and stick them in the beef market and just get what I could at them. Obviously they're going to get labeled as exotics, and I'm not going to get, you know, a premium on them, but I'm going to dump to try to get myself through. So that was the first thing I saw. And then you think about it, and some of that happened. It didn't happen as much as I thought because we kind of PPP and sort of kept ourselves afloat that way, or kept that industry floating. And then all of the restaurant closures were going on. And then you started to see people buying lots of freezers. And when people are buying freezers that have never owned a deep freeze before, you know what they're doing. They're trying to store meat. Well, you have all these packers, you know, that in the ag industry, as you know, but other people don't, beef, pork, chicken, they go through this bottleneck of the packers. And on the beef side, I believe there's four packers, and I think only two of them are even owned by American companies now. One's Brazil, and then I think the other one's China's. I don't know, China owns the pork. But anyway, so all of the meat goes through this funnel, you know, it bottlenecks. And if they're putting these restrictions in where they're limiting capacity, well, I mean, it wasn't that hard to see, you know, put two and two together. And then the other problem that you're going to have is fuel was really cheap, but we're in a drought out west. So hay prices are still high, even with cheap fuel. And I was just, in my brain, I was thinking there's no way that fuel can stay, because I think I paid $1.16 for farm fuel last year. And I was thinking there's just no way red diesel can stay at $1.16. So that's going to go up. And hay prices are already high. So small ranchers are going to start dumping cattle. I mean, and then there's, you know, obviously that's going to have a minimal impact on the market, but I was just seeing the way all of these things, at least in my mind, the way all of these things were going to work together, it was going to make it so, you know, spring, like next time auctions come around, it's going to be a nightmare. And we had another thing, I'm sorry. They canceled all the horse auctions out here in the spring. And that's going to, I mean, I know it doesn't sound like it would impact beef, but it would, because the bigger, the guys like me who train horses, we make most of our money at sales. Well, if you cancel those sales, then those horses are going to get dumped on like Craigslist and this kind of stuff, because you can't just feed a horse for another year hoping that sales come back one day. So when you kind of add all of this, the way that ties to beef is it makes it so more people are buying horses, which is going to drive hay, or make it harder to get hay and drive hay prices up. So it's just all of these little things tied together were looking to me like this is going to be a problem, and it's not going to manifest until next spring, because the problem happens now. You know, like, let's say the problem happened today. Well, in the ag space, like, you're feeling it, like you might be dealing with all of those issues now, but you only get paid twice a year anyway. So you're not going to, it just won't manifest until the next year, you know? Anyway, so that's what made me think of it.
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, you know, for somebody who's done this for, you know, almost a full 25 years, you know, that's what I spend my life doing. And on that day in particular, and I want to go back with you on that day, and I almost feel like I'm interviewing you, but I'm not, because I want to figure out, you know, how a guy, you know, punching cows and busting colts, is sitting here reviewing the world around him in such a micro versus a macro, because you're viewing your personal situation into a sense where you're calling a national sort of reaction to a personal experience you're having, which most people cannot do. Most people in our space, in the commodity space, do not do this accurately. So, on the day that you did it, you sent that out on April 27th of last year. And you know, for me, what I was doing on that day is I was working almost 24 hours around the clock. And what you describe, what we call demand destruction, right? So You have relatively known demand across every commodity, whether you're doing food input in the ag space for like sugar and grains, wheat, corn, versus driving demand or airline demand or industrial demand for polymers and anything with the ane on the end, or an ene, anything that makes plastic, right? So We have data that basically tells us almost every day of the week out for several years what the demand for commodities looks like. And when you have an event like that took place, you know, it was, you know, I was sleeping about 4 hours a night. I was on the phone with Europe at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I was on the phone with Singapore at, you know, from about 10 o'clock at night, my time, until about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I would sleep for 2 hours here and there. And we were trying to decide, you know, how is this going to work today? So a couple notes for you. On April 20th, so 7 days, a week before you sent that out, that was the day that the crude oil market crashed and futures traded $37 under. Under zero, so negative. So people were paying to give crude away at some of the, you know, Midwest terminals. That physical crude was also being paid to be taken away that day in the cash market. So people were buying it, you know, people were getting paid to show up with a truck or a rail car or a barge to take products and crude. And that was remarkable. That was a big eye-opening event for a lot of people. We didn't think the futures market could trade negative. In theory, it should. So 7 days later, after that day, and you get your trip canceled on the 27th. So crude oil that day was trading $12 a barrel. Corn was trading $3. It closed at $3.05, and soybeans were trading $8.30 a bushel. Lumber was $3.15. Wheat was trading $5.21 a bushel. And there's a slew of other things we could talk about, but these sort of fold into where you went with this, right? So, and I want to refer back to another podcast you did with a really smart guy, Joe Clements. He made a point that I wanted to make, which is in the ranch farm space, the biggest input is energy, right? Mm-hmm. So you're sitting here looking at, and even if it's fertilizer, which is an energy byproduct, you're looking at it, relatively speaking, the margins for corn and beans were pretty good. When you're looking at your energy inputs, the margins for cattle were pretty good. You were able to see, you know, there was a margin in the ag market at that day, but that margin very quickly vanished. Yeah. The bottleneck you talked about in sort of the packing market, it was almost immediate. You ended up with the JBSs of the world started reporting COVID and shutting down. You know, they immediately started mm-hmm. shutting down shifts. The big plant in Colorado, right on the Colorado, New Mexico, somewhere down around Colorado, New Mexico border, that plant was shut down for weeks. That just doesn't happen in that space. And so you see these little trickle down things that happen. And you think to yourself, okay, well, how in the world are we going to have a beef shortage today? You got to it.
Yeah.
The majority of people don't. And there's a reason we believe in the commodity space for that. And that is the average person. And I'm going to give you a brief story as to sort of how sort of commodity supply chain and sort of these bottlenecks and how my fear for the point you made is actually going to exacerbate itself over the next, I think, 5 years. The average human thinks about their life in a day, a minute, a week, and then they might sometimes think about it over the next year, and they very seldom think about it over the next 5 years. We sort of, as we train people in commodities to sort of look at how we do forward hedging, the average person, I think, very much overestimates what they can do in a year. They get excited and they think, oh, I can do this, or I can make a move, or I could learn a new subject, or learn to cook, or pick any type of a thing a human wants to do. And they kind of, they tend to overestimate, but on a 3, 4, and 5 year scale, they very much underestimate because they can't get their head wrapped around the nuances of how much they can do. Right. So there's this mm-hmm. big gap in people's thinking. These supply chain issues that we went through, and we're starting to really feel them today. We went over the prices on April 27th, in 2020 last year. And I'll just give you the quick rundown of what we can't imagine a year later. So it's been a year. Mm-hmm. Crude oil, $12.90 last year. It closed at $65 today a barrel. Corn closed at $3.05 a year ago. It closed at $6.44 today. And I'm going to give you a caveat. Corn was $1 a bushel higher last week. A lot of the sell-off on that had to do with the bridge over the Mississippi that just opened up this morning a few hours ago with 1,000 barges on it backlogged. Same with beans. Beans last year, $8.29, they closed at $15.91. Lumber, which has been the big story that everyone wants to talk about, closed at $3.15 last year. It is now five times higher at $15.66.
Jeez.
So that's a big one. Wheat, not so much. $5.21 up to $7.27. And we can pick those commodities out all over the place. And, you know, to talk about supply chain, right? And you know, a lot of the people that we interacted with on this, they brought up different things. We talked about wire mm-hmm. Yesterday. We talked about plastics. People are talking, you know, and obviously a big one that a lot of people that we communicate with is ammo, right? And you get these demand-driven things.
Yep.
That pulls in many different directions. And the one that everyone wants to always talk about is when they get too expensive. And it's a lot of it has to do with how you control the supply chain. And, you know, in the meat business, you have four packers, two of which are American, the other two are foreign.
Right.
In my opinion, it should be more. And, you know, when we talk about supply chain, Braxton, 30 years ago, your supply chain was arguably, for everything you used in your daily life, your supply chain could have been found within 1500 down to 500 miles at max for assembly, production, marketing. Mm-hmm. We had not outsourced our supply chain yet. So in theory, these problems that we're dealing with are a bit of our own making. I think when you start talking about the semiconductor squeeze right now, here's an interesting one for you. And I'm sorry to go on a tangent here. I saw photos last week in two places. One, they got sent to me internally within my firm just because we were having a discussion about semiconductors. And then I saw it on Zero Hedge. On I-71 between Louisville, Kentucky and Cincinnati, there's a little town called Sparta. And the Super Duty truck factory for Ford is in Louisville, Kentucky. They apparently have leased out these lots along I-71. They have 25,000 250s and 350s sitting there waiting for chips. completely finished. Yes, they do.
Oh my gosh. So that's why people can't get trucks right now, is because they're waiting on a computer chip. Holy cow.
That's correct. So you're tweeting about beef, right? And you're tweeting about, you know, and you're seeing this happening. Well, my job, and what we do is yes, that, but we look more to sort of the macro, and it's like, you know, what is it going to look like to the individual when he's going to go try to order, what do they call it? Uber Eats, right? So Uber Eats is right in front of your face. So if your Uber Eats bill goes from 25 for two people to eat to $40, you kind of don't notice it. Mm-hmm. But if you can't buy a car, or if your house cost is, you know, up $200,000 over year to year, now all of a sudden people are going, wait a minute, what does inflation really look like? What is inflation? How do you measure it? Who cares? Nobody cares about inflation until it affects them personally.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. You see, yeah. And that's an interesting, I was actually just talking to my buddy that's here about that when we were in my garage, and I was saying, you know, I think Fed just said inflation's at about 3% for this year, which is just insane. I look at it like what is, like, to your point, what does inflation even mean? It, like, they can, you know, measure it however they want, but I guess maybe perceived inflation is different than actual inflation, but to the everyday person, the perceived inflation is all that matters. Like, that's the only thing they care about. I had a couple of projects I wanted to do. I went into the lumber yard, this is about 3 months ago, to buy stuff. And, you know, at that time, 2x4s were already up like double from what they usually are. And I just said, screw that. I don't have the money to pay double to build this damn barn, you know? So is that inflation? I don't know, but it's certainly perceived inflation, and that's bad enough. And the supply chain, and this is what was really part of what was, this was the underlying thing of what I was worried about last year, is just from like time in the military. And then of course, working in the ag sector, is I know how logistics work, and it's a great big machine, and it moves like a slinky. You compress that sucker down, it's not just going to like bounce right back out. You got to uncoil and start over. So you can't just like stop, start that thing. You know, it's like almost like traffic at a traffic light. Like my old man used to always say, if everyone would just go when it turned green, there would be no traffic. I mean, he's kind of right about that, but it's not how it works. So the first car goes, the second car goes, and so on. Same thing, you know, happens in the supply chain. So you just can't, at least this is how I look at it. You just can't expect to shut that thing off in all of the ways that we did and not feel those effects down the road. Like, it's not going to be an overnight thing, you know?
You are exactly correct. And over the last 20 years, I think, you know, 30 years ago, I think the mindset started changing, but over the last 20 years, we've seen, such a rejiggering of the supply chain. And I'm talking about the big picture. Of what do we do here as a country? Obviously, everyone wants to see more manufacturing and more America made. And a lot of that, I think, has been dialed down to either some sort of an ideology, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, well, you know, I'm a nationalist and I want to support America and I want to do this, or I don't care and I'm a sort of a larger worldview picture. I'm a citizen of the globe. Mm-hmm. Well, the people that foster the argument for sort of a global supply chain are the first people who are going to complain when they find out that we've relinquished control of the supply chain to people who just 100% do not care whether or not you get to go to Target and get your X, whatever it is. It's morphed into almost, I'd say, an issue that people are going to wake up and realize when and how we get squeezed. Obviously, we are just coming off of the Colonial Pipeline hack, and we just watched the Eastern United States get squeezed on gasoline supply. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's not much that can be said about that, other than if that's not a wake-up call, I don't know what it is, or what could be a bigger wake-up call. You have the semiconductor issue, which that extends all the way to the military. Mm-hmm. That extends to PCs and computing, food. You know, I began, and this is, I'm going to digress a little bit, right? So from 2000, sort of 1996 to 2000. I was just a green rookie. I mean, literally a college dropout. I have the worst punctuation. I should be punching cows in a bunkhouse right now, and I'm not. And there are days that I wish I had done that. There are days I wish I hadn't. So I'm sort of call my first 4 or 5 years in the business kind of blind luck, kind of stumbling around behind people trying to figure things out. And I'd say at 2000, 2001, I really figured out sort of what my niche was, and it's transactional. I'm very good at seeing sort of the way the big picture works and putting together really large export deals, import deals, hedging, options, and understanding sort of what you talked about, which was the slinky effect. I call it the accordion. I understand the accordion, and I'm fairly good and adept at seeing how the accordion is going to affect things coming down the road. But because of that, in 2007, I was invited to a private equity sort of boondoggle. And it was a bunch of investment firms, all of them looking at private equity across the ag sector. The premise was dairy, of all things that I was invited to. The guy that invited me was an orange juice guy, and I'm the energy guy, and I was asked to speak. And so, you know, my speech there was ultimately only about 20 minutes, but this thing lasted for 2 days. During the 2 days, one of the speakers was a man named Dr. David E. Bell. I will never forget his name. I still moderately have communication with him, but he spoke. He was a Harvard Agriculture Business School professor, and his specialty was food, but it wasn't specialty necessarily for food and supply chain in the United States. It was global, and his biggest non-Harvard client was the government of China. I gave some piddly speech about how we use algorithms to forecast pricing for electricity so that people can look at 5-year electricity on demand curves. And to be honest, I don't remember what I said. It was probably nonsense. but this guy spoke for about 2 hours, and it dragged into three. Then it turned into a question session. And I listened to him. And for the first time in my life, I realized that I had missed the big picture on supply chain, commodities, and what we talked about earlier. So sort of how you see your life 5 or 10, or, you know, who, I mean, 10 years down the road, are you kidding me? I can't even imagine that far.
Right.
He explained to me, you know, that the Chinese government, which, by the way, as part of this, what you learn is that it's that the big swing vote in all commodities pricing is going to be China, whether or not they're buying or selling ultimately influences, because known demand around the world is really influenced on their growth, whether they're increasing or decreasing growth, because they are such a massive net consumer of everything. But David E. Bell explains, with graph overlays in the ag space in particular, that they are so short food to feed their population, because they basically took their population from being a subsistence farmers, hand-to-mouth food, where a portion of that would be obviously taken and redistributed, to an urban society. They're shifting their population urban away from farming. And quite frankly, their land is not, it's not arid enough to be able to produce enough food, corn, wheat, beans, proteins, to supply their population. And they have a 25-year, they have a 5-year, 25-year, 50-year, and 100-year plan for doing this. And they're executing it today. And it is fascinating.
Can I jump in here quick? When I was
absolutely
a kid, I kind of get into this stuff. I don't know. I like data. Kind of data cache gives me something to think about when I'm on a cult, but I got into looking at what they're doing in, or have been doing, to Australia for a few years. And I got thinking, when I was a kid, it seemed like we shipped beef to China. And then somewhere between 30 years ago and now, it turned into, now we ship alfalfa. And I was told that they just, because they can't grow alfalfa over there for a number of reasons. So what they did was, instead of buying beef from us, they said, well, it'd be a heck of a lot cheaper if we just start raising beef over here, but we can't really feed them. So we just import corn, alfalfa, you know, beans, all this kind of stuff. And you take a ton of alfalfa bale, ship it to California, and then they compress it and put it on a cargo ship and ship that thing over. So they went from importing beef, which was relatively expensive, to now importing alfalfa, which is relatively which is cheap relative to beef. When you look at that, I the reason that I think that that is a massive liability for us is because we've already centralization, in my opinion, is always a bad thing. Decentralization is almost always better. And now the ag industry is highly centralized. Like most production is an agribusiness. I know, like if you get on the FDA, it will say, or USDA, it will say, 92% of farms in America are family owned. And it's like, yeah, well, families own corporations, dude. I get what you're trying to say.
I was going to say the Cargill family.
Right. It's just so ridiculous. But yeah, the small guy is virtually gone. Like take it. When I was a kid, a person could, they would never be rich, but they could make a living off 100 head of cattle. You could no way in hell feed your family off 100 head of cattle now. There's no way on a cattle operation. Not even close.
Not even close.
So, clearly, there's some serious issues going on there. And I perceive China the same way they perceive me, at least it seems, as an enemy. So we were in a trade, like Trump exacerbated this trade war, spun it up. And then this coronavirus thing hit. And, you know, like Rahm Emanuel famously said, never let a good crisis go to waste. Well, if you're China, it seems like a really good time to put the screws to America. So where fuel prices are going through the roof right now. Alfalfa production's already started, of course, but you know, no one's cut yet, but production started. Here in about, I don't know, September or so, if I was China, I would just halt import. I would say, nope, we're good. I don't even care. If I'm China, I don't even care if I have to slaughter every freaking beef that I have in China. I don't even care. Just to put the screws to America, because you could, I mean, I'm not saying they will do this, but that's a move that I could see them making. And that would really, really damage the ag sector big time. I mean, it would cripple us for 5-10 years, you know?
It is. So, you know, from my the professional side of me, right, that would never happen. This is this business decision. Well, I can tell you that after listening to a United States citizen, obviously professor at a school that I would imagine this would come from, explaining to me how he helped them write their plan on how to feed their country and what that looks like. And he sat in a room with other Americans. Braxton, it changed my life. I've never forgotten what I heard. It's changed the way I do business. It's changed the way I saw my career path taking. I became much more, it changed me into a nationalist in knowing that and I've dealt with the Chinese for 20 years, you said they are my enemy. In the commodity space, they are our enemy. They're friend. Mm-hmm. Every trading house, right? So anybody that is aggregating at a grain elevator, putting corn, beans, wheat, ag products, energy products onto a barge or a ship and running them down a river and exporting them to China is a private industry in the United States. There's no state-run mechanism for agriculture or energy, right?
But
every deal we do with China is done via state-run businesses, Unipec, PetroChina. They're two big ag companies, right? So when we sign a contract to export our goods and services, we are literally selling it to a country, not like we do when we go to Europe or, South America. Well, South America's got some other nuances as well. But everything they do is controlled by the government. Every purchase, every sale, when they come in and, you know, they pre-buy 20 cargoes of corn, right? 25 cargoes of corn. What you said is very astute. They will buy these things where the corn market will go into steep backwardation, which is where the price today is, the commodity is short, right? So there's pressure in the front, right? Which pushes the price today up versus the price in, say, December, significantly lower, right? Well, they'll dump it. They don't care. They will do what they call cancel cargoes, and that corn will immediately come back into the market here, right? Mm-hmm. So it never leaves. It comes back, and then we become awash with corn, and we go from $7 a bushel or $6.50 a bushel back to $2.85 a bushel it absolutely wrecks our economy. We've given away our supply chain, and it's in the ag space, it's a little easier to see it. It's a lot harder to see it when you start looking into the electronics or the plastics. You know, for months, in the beginning of this year, the EIA, which reports sort of global balance sheet statistics for, gasoline products, oil products, refined products all around the world, there were these sort of empty holes about where these products were going. We don't trust the Chinese enough on their numbers that we will run satellites that will look at their tank space to see how much fuel that they have in shore tanks. How many ships do they have offshore that they're hoarding? And for the life of us, we could not figure out what was going on because there was this consumption of gasoline and diesel and jet fuel and propane, butane, ethane, ethylene, polypropylene. There's all these light end and refined product end products that were vanishing off the balance sheet and prices were ripping. But the demand that we were seeing was not increasing at the same rate the products were disappearing. And, you know, finally, some guy's like, look, he's like, I think China has more storage than we know. Like, we just don't know. You cannot be an American energy trading company and have a fully functioning office in China. There are offices over there. If you're in that office, you are a partner with a Chinese company. There's no transparency. I believe that they picked up and bought as much as they possibly could to start turning the screws to the rest of the globe. They've done it in ags. They'll do it again. People think, oh, that's far-fetched. That would never happen. That's just not true. They're thinking 50 years ahead.
Right.
They are working in Africa to develop seeds that will grow staple foods in the desert. And American universities have been helping them for years.
Right. I saw that.
They are doing debt colonization all over Latin America, all over Africa. And they're doing these, you know, you've seen them. I think a lot of people listening have seen them, but they'll go in and they'll do these sovereign debt deals with smaller, poorer countries that have natural resources.
Yep.
Rare earth minerals. I mean, you want to talk about a cluster. The rare earth mineral, our dependence on rare earth minerals and this battery push that's going, are you joking me?
Right. Yeah, I mean, between Belt and Road and all of that, I mean, the next war that we fight might be over lithium in Africa. And I think a lot of people don't, I don't know if it's they don't pay attention enough or don't understand it, but I actually think it's entirely possible that we end up in a proxy conflict with China in Africa over lithium within 10 years.
Yeah, lithium or cobalt. It'll be one of the two.
Yep.
And I agree. And so let's circle back. You were right. We are experiencing shortages in different commodities. The real question is what does the average person do? And I think that's one that we all need to talk about. You know, what can a person who does not understand commodities or doesn't understand supply chain, you know, what do they do so they don't wake up and go, oh, I can't buy this anymore.
Right. Well, I'm hesitant to give anybody advice, but I'll say what I'm doing. We have a baby on the way and we're already buying. Every time I go to, you know, the store for groceries, we're buying extra diapers for the kid that's not even here, storing as much flour as we can. And then I tripled the size of just my home garden, or I'm going to triple the size of my home garden this year just to try to help, help get through. And then of course I got some cattle so I can slaughter cattle, but it doesn't, if I was someone else, I'm hesitant to give advice, to take this with a grain of salt, but I would, if you can even get one, I would get a deep freezer and I would not even look at the price tag and I would fill that sucker up with beef and pork right now. That's what I'd do.
Yeah. So you're also, I think, in a very different situation than I'd say probably 95% of people, right? Maybe even more than that. You've got urbanites, for us, and I also hesitate to give anybody advice. I'm just a lucky guy from Wyoming. But we've lived in the city of Houston for the last 4 years, and it was an urbanization experiment with my Miss Goya and I. We've always lived rural. And it was exciting. It was fun. You know, we can ride our bikes to the to restaurants, and we'd never been able to do that. And so it's been a real convenience change for me. And I now have a real grasp of what convenience looks like. I'd never had it before. I didn't know I was missing anything. And I understand the gravity to which people are attracted to it. You do less. Your life is built around less and less every day. Your kids do less. It becomes really a self-serving, almost selfish view of how you live. You don't have to do anything. If you have a phone, you don't have to go to the store. You don't have to order, sure. You don't have to cook food. You don't have to do your laundry. Every single thing you need to do is one push button away. All you need to do is be able to figure out how to electronically transfer money to pay for it. Yeah. And that person is going to struggle with what you just mentioned. And so we've changed our life. I was off the Bird app for months.
I didn't like it. I wondered where you went.
Well, Ms. Goy and I, every year we sit back and reevaluate our lives. And we made a conscious decision in January to change it. And we're leaving. We close on our house in the city, I think, in 3 weeks. And I'm going to destinations afar, back out into the country.
Good.
And I'm going to retool my life in a manner in which you spoke. And the only advice, you know, because I think that a lot of people aren't going to necessarily change their life situation like I was able to do. I think that if you can, I do think that at least getting yourself out of an urban center like I'm in is smart, if possible. I also think that if you don't have the resources and capability to run cattle, even a small amount of cattle or chickens or any type of a protein, that there are local farmers and local businesses that you should become acquainted with. I know that around Houston, there's 4 or 5 family-run cattle operations where I can go get a side of beef tomorrow. And I think that it takes place outside of most urban environments. I think that being able to urban farm and vertical farm, we do, even in the city on a tiny lot, we've figured out a way. Ms. Goya runs tomatoes and peppers and lettuces and all sorts of food. I mean, we get more food out of a tiny area than probably most people would get out of a quarter acre garden. And so I think there are things people can do. I do think that deep freezers, if you know, space warrants, are 100% something that should always be in a rotation for people. And I do think that networking, and you know, a friend of ours, you know, and I'm going to bring it up because Clay Martin wrote that book, The Concrete Jungle Book. And I've actually given that book to a lot of people. And I'm not necessarily thinking that there's going to be some catastrophic, cataclysmic, you know, urban sort of rush. But when you look at what took place with Colonial Pipeline being closed down for 1 week and the gas shortages and people filling Target bags, we are very sensitive to minor disruptions in the accordion or the slinky of the supply chain, and we don't control them anymore. And I do think that having a base knowledge of how to be able to function in those types of situations controls the panic, right? You don't see people filling up Target bags with gasoline. I saw a video of that. I didn't know what to say.
Yeah, that was really something. But no, yeah, you're right. Community is huge. It's when I was a kid, I lived around a lot of Mormon guys, and you know, they're really big on that. And when you know, they kind of got made fun of, but I remember John Stewart back when I was in school. I think I remember him when I was in college talking crap about Mormons and how silly they were, like they were a cult of preppers and all of that. And I mean, imagine how smug you'd feel if you were a prepper Mormon right now with all your damn, you know, canned potatoes and all that in your basement, you know.
It's remarkable. The Mormons have been catching a bad rap, you know, since I was a kid. It's a widely practiced religion in Wyoming, and you know, half my friends were Mormons, and they all canned food, and they all saved meat, but the sense of community as well is definitely something you can emulate, and few people do it. Braxton, I live in an urban environment, and I'm telling you, I just don't. There are people here that during the freeze that we had when there was no electricity, I mean, you're talking about, you know, 3, 4, 5 days, and it was desperation. There was no food. There was no water with these houses that were shut off, and people were laughing because, you know, they're saying, oh, well, it's Texas. They can't handle a cold snap and a freeze. But
Jay, that you can just say me. That's okay.
I felt the same way. I grew up obviously in central Wyoming, and I understand winter, but I will tell you that the reaction here was telling. It was scary that there's so many people that live in this, you know, I think the Metroplex is 5 million people. It was completely 100% shut down, Braxton. Everything was shut down. There was, if you did not have food and water, you didn't eat for 48 hours. And I think there was a significant amount of people who live sort of in that range, right? They live sort of in a 48 to sort of 72 hour convenience bubble of what they can survive on. In my opinion, that's too short.
Yeah. Yep. You're right. And you know, you said canning in there. My wife and I can't, I used to, well, before I met her, I used to do some canning on my own, but she does all of it now. And, it's really not hard to can, and it's something that, or, you know, jar or whatever, however you want to say that, it's really not a hard thing to do. And it's probably wise. Like she'll can a bunch of chicken, for example. She does it every year, and I take it, if I'm going in the backcountry for a while, I just pull it out of the can and stick it in a bag and stick it in my saddlebags, you know, and then I have like 4 pounds of chicken just on my horse when I go somewhere, you know. And you could do that just as easy in any kind of sort of crunch scenario, you know. Even if you can't heat it up, it's cooked, you know, it's pre-cooked and safe. You might have to eat it cold, but at least you're eating. So that's a thing that I think anybody could do. You can right on your, you know, your stovetop.
Of course.
You don't need anything fancy. A lot of people think they need fancy stuff. You really don't. And before I met her, I canned in just a damn, I had me one of them, I forget what you call it, but it's almost like a iron scissor deal that'll grab the top of the jar, and I just drop them in boiling water and just can right there. No pressure cooker or nothing, you know?
No. And, you know, the irony of all of this is that we willfully gave this away. Yeah. It's big corporations. It's the bottlenecks that have been created. They're of our own doing. Yeah. And you know, before I sign off here, I want to thank you, because you did a great service. You know, people always say, well, how does this change? Well, it changes if we can find 200 more Joe Kents. You know, that's it. Other than that, I don't know how it changes. You know, if we don't change the trajectory of the way people view our life and liberty, then all of the bottlenecks, all of the shortages, all of the inconveniences that we don't want are going to increase. That's because nobody else wants them. You know, they don't want us to succeed. No one does. We're going to have to do it on our own. So, Braxton, I want to thank you again for having Joe Kent on. I want to have, you know, thank you for keeping to push these issues out to the forefront. And I'm glad we could talk about them.
Thank you for coming on, sir. I think that's a great place to leave it. I appreciate you.
I do too. And by the way, if you ever if Goya 3 is ever sleeping in your barn one morning, just promise me you'll keep him fed while he tries to follow you around.
Shoot me a text first so I know he's out there.
But, yeah. I will, buddy. I appreciate it.
Take care, sir. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, that's it. Thank you all. I appreciate you listening. And a reminder again, if you want to get a copy of my book, The Glass Factory, in hardcover, autograph, now is a good time to do it. You go to my website, BraxMcCoy.com/The Glass Factory, and you can pick that thing up for pretty cheap, and we'll ship it to you for free. Thank you all again for the support. If you haven't left a review, please do so at this time. It really helps us. And that's it. I want to say thanks again to my friend Javier Goya and to y'all for listening. Take care. Have a good week.